And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at those times at richarddugan.com. And then the podcasts are placed on SoundCloud, and then they are updated at Spotify. And where else are we? TuneIn Radio. And I'm trying to think of all of the different places, and we're trying to expand that list. Stitcher is another place. iTunes. I already mentioned SoundCloud, but they're also available at richarddugan.com, the homepage, when you first log into richarddugan.com. Actually, you're not logging in, but when you go there, as well as the radio shows page, where you can then listen to past years, 2017 back to 2007. 2018 is up on SoundCloud, and we are into 2019, and they are also available on SoundCloud. So lots of opportunities. And speaking of SoundCloud, if you're listening to the SoundCloud link, which is probably going to be the link wherever you go, there's a little grocery cart in the upper right-hand corner when you start playing that file, that audio interview. That's the link to our guest's website. Now, when you go to the radio shows page of richarddugan.com, it's the name. Their name is the link that takes you to their website. We want you to go there and continue your evolutionary process. We'll be giving our guest's website out as shortly as we begin this interview. And also, if you would like to support this program, we are more than grateful for every bit of support that you can send our way. We do have a PayPal account, and if you'd like to go to the link on the homepage as well as on the missions page, maybe this is the first time you've listened to Tell Me Your Story and you're not quite sure what we're all about, you can go there during this interview, read about what it is that we're doing here and what we're trying to accomplish, and that is to help make your dreams come true, among other things. And click on that PayPal link and give what you can. We'll even take energetic support. We're not picky from that standpoint, but we are definitely appreciative of any monetary support you can give us. And also, one more thing, and that is, if you're listening to the radio version of this broadcast, you're going to want to listen to the podcast, because we go much longer than the 50 minutes that we spend here on the radio program. Stay with us, and we will be sharing that with you here on Tell Me Your Story. And today we're going to be telling the story of a woman who has put together a very, in my opinion, a very interesting, unique, I think it's a lot of fun, and I think it's also quite inspirational as well. A book that you're going to want to investigate, because it's dealing with a subject that we've talked about many times on this program, but it's a little bit more pinpointed, and I think that's very cool, especially considering architecture as we do these days, and art. And that happens to be my guest, who is Sylvia Moss, and she is the creator, if you will, the author, the photographer, if you will. Angels of New York. It is would you call it a pictorial, Sylvia?
Yeah, it kind of covers many areas. It's kind of almost like a travel book, but it's pictorial, yeah.
And a meditative photographic journey through New York City. Which almost seems those terms, meditative and New York City, are sort of diametrically opposed, if you will, or mutually exclusive, kind of like military intelligence. However,
exactly.
Well, first of all, thank you for joining us here on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted.
I think we're going to get along just fine. My mother's first name is Sylvia, so we'll...
Oh, how delightful.
That'll work out well. And I seem to recall it was when my sister, eldest sister, came of age. I seem to recall she changed her name, either her first or middle name, although we still call her by the name that my parents gave her. She changed her name to my mother's name, so I thought that was rather interesting.
Oh. Now,
this is,
my mother's name is Sylvia also, so.
Oh, my goodness.
Nothing in there.
Well, this is wonderful. We've got that connection there. There's synergy here. Now, this particular work that you've created has to do with these various images throughout the city of New York, and it's rather interesting that I can understand why someone would want to would want to focus on the subject of angels. I mean, my gosh, we can use all the help we can get. We hear about how each of us has guardian angels that are with us throughout our lives, following us, if we would but, you know, kind of open up our hearts and minds, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there are those who they want to express their appreciation through the arts. And they've done that in particular, in your case, in New York City, where you live.
Yes.
How did this idea come to you?
Oh, that's such a fun story. Fun for me. I don't know if anyone else would be interested or not. But I have a friend who, at the time, was one of the landmarks commissioners of New York City. And he was mainly in charge of the sacred sites, churches and other kinds of sacred places. And they were going to be doing some renovation and possibly tearing down a church, and so he needed some snapshots. And so we went over just, you know, for 15 minutes to take some snapshots of this church. And it was horrible, horribly freezing, windy, terrible New York day. And when we were in the cab coming back home, he started talking to me about an exhibition that some of my angels were in at the time and wanted to know how it was going. And, you know, we're chatting about that. And he paused, you know, one of those very dramatic pauses. And he looked out the window and he said, you know, why don't you do a book about angels and call it Angels of New York? Well, I screamed, and the cab driver pushed on the brakes. Thought something was terribly wrong. And because I'd been waiting for, you know, people say, I'm looking for a sign. I want a sign. Well, that's exactly what this was. Because I had had an astrology reading maybe only 5 years ago or so. And she said, you know, there's three books in you. You're going to be publishing three books. I said, I'm not a writer. You know, how's that possible? And so that's why I screamed, because I, you know, and so the rest is history.
Well, now, what about the influence of angels in your life?
Oh, well, that's really interesting, because I wrote the book as like a play script. So in the prologue, I talk about that, because I never really thought about that I had angels following me, or that I even, you know, talked to them or they talked to me. But when I started doing the book, I started going back and trying to remember if I had any encounters. And I did remember that my first time of even maybe thinking about angels was when I was maybe 14 or 15 and my grandmother was dying. And she said, oh, look, up there on the ceiling, she was pointing to, look at the angels, they're here to help us. And I looked up and I, just to, you know, support her, I said, oh, yes, and, you know, I didn't even think that I saw angels. But then looking back, I really did. I mean, I like when children speak to their imaginary friends, well, it was like that. I always was talking to somebody. And so then I realized that's you know, that was my first encounter. But on not on a visual level. It was always a sensory level, knowing, more about it, like a knowing kind of a thing.
I'm not sure where to focus my attention first on the sculptures of angels or the pictures, images and so forth. I'm just wondering how many public, and maybe you don't have an exact number, but I mean, are there a number of public buildings that you found that have images of angels, whether they be in three-dimensional or on a two-dimensional canvas, that kind of thing?
Yes, yes. Most of the buildings, I'm trying to go back, most of the buildings were churches, but there were more outside angels than inside buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one that sort of walks both worlds, inside and churches, with one that was in the, or still is in, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, because that was in a church at one time, and the church was torn down, and the angel statue and the choir rail with the, oh, maybe, 50 angels carved on it. It's absolutely exquisite. It's now in the Met. So that was in a church. A lot of them are outdoors, which was surprising to me because I had no idea that they were public monuments for the public. There's a famous one in Central Park. It's called, the actual technical name is Angels of the Waters, and she's at the site of Bethesda Terrace, which is a very, very famous landmark and tourist spot in New York City. And on the weekends, it's just covered with people, and people, you know, doing juggling acts and musical acts, and people wandering around because she's a fountain and she's in a great big open space. And she became even more famous in the TV movie Angels of New York from the play, because she was the opening spot that you when the movie opens, the first thing you see is this angel, and she was very large. And she turns her head in this movie. So she's the Bethesda Fountain Angels, mainly what she's called. But she's quite exquisite, yeah.
So actually, there was a movie that came out prior to your particular work.
Yes. It's the play. It's a Pulitzer Prize play, Angels of New York.
2010, I believe it is, about 8 years ago. Yeah, 9 years ago.
Yes. Angels in America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's the one that she's the centerpiece for.
It's very interesting.
Go
ahead.
But then there recently, on another show, actually, that I was being interviewed, a woman, the host, right after we had our show, she went to watch TV, and on the TV was the new show called Manifest. I've not seen it.
I've seen some of it, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know if it was the first show or if it was in the middle. I don't remember all the details. But this angel, the Bethesda angel, was in that, and she walks on the ground in that one. So this woman, this angel is really becoming very well known, and it was all about, you know, supernatural kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
fascinating to me, especially because of the I guess my upbringing, my own personal upbringing. I was born and raised Roman Catholic, Western Rite of the Catholic Church. And
yeah,
angels were a huge part of my upbringing. You know, Michael, you know, and Gabriel,
yeah,
and the archangels and so forth.
Yeah.
And I'm curious as to if you have information on the history of some of these angels in New York, the photographs that you have taken that are in your book, the history of why they were put there, why they were put in that space. I can understand the churches. That sort of makes,
yeah,
there's a logical connection there.
Yeah.
But I know that there had to have been angels placed in other places. Well, you just said this angel in the park. I mean, how long had that been there, and why was it put there? Do you have, and you don't have to focus specifically on that one, but just in general, was there something that these people knew about the city of New York and its transformation into the future? They wanted to have some kind of symbolic hedge of protection, if you will, by the angels.
Right. Well, it's kind of a combination. I don't know if when they were installed, if they were thinking of the future, but in this case, what I know, and that's what's in the book, because each angel has her story, or his whatever they are. They're androgynous, though, but I call them she, because most of the angels in those days depicted, they look like women. And there's some very famous stories in some churches. In the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, the angels that are there were sculpted by a very famous sculptor by the name of Borglum, I forget his first name, And he was the man that sculpted Mount Rushmore.
Oh, wow.
And he did, yeah, and he did a lot of angels and a lot of the art in St. John the Divine. And there was a big rift in the beginning, in, you know, 1900s, very, you know, very, very male. And his angels looked too much like women. And they made him take them down and redo them and make them look like men. And he fought them like crazy. But in the end, he finally did put them down, bring them down. And, but they still, to me, they still look, they're very feminine.
Mm.
But they, every angel that's in my book, I'm not sure about the cemetery angels, because there are a lot more angels that I didn't get a chance to photograph, because there were actually just too many.
Mm-hmm.
Which blew me away. They had a purpose. Like the one in Central Park, is that it's a very famous story, and I put a biblical text in because it's named after, in the Bible, John 5 something, and the angel came down and stilled the waters or something of that sort, and Jesus said, walk. And the ill people picked up their mat, and it's that whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was a cholera epidemic in New York City, and this was 1870, something like that, and they decided that it was the water, and they had to change the reservoir. I don't even know if they had a reservoir. But they built this very elaborate reservoir, which we still have. It's our West Reservoir now. It's upstate New York. And to commemorate this immense project and the saving of lives, they built this fountain. And they called it Bethesda Fountain, after the biblical text. And they had this big, huge commemoration. And this angel commemorates the healing of the waters. And Parks Commissioner at the time had a sister, and she was a sculptor. And he commissioned her to do this incredibly beautiful angel. And then there's the one in Columbus Circle, which is a very, very famous landmark. Columbus Circle, which is in front of the Time Warner building now.
Mm.
And it's just a beautiful location. And that's a teenage angel. It's a little boy. And he's at the foot of this tall, tall column of Columbus, and the story goes that this angel was Columbus's guide to discovering America. So each one of them has their own story. And it's interesting that you should ask that, because no one's asked that before.
It just seems to me like the various attributes within a city, regardless of where it is in the world. The various attributes were put there for a reason by, you know, the people who were living there at the time.
Yes.
And you move forward in time, 500, 1,000, 2,000, however many years, and you sit there looking at that going, why is that still there? And why was it put there in the first place? And mm-hmm. the thing that always gets me, and part of the reason I brought it up in terms of asking about public buildings having angels on them,
yeah.
I'm wondering, and I don't want to go down this road too far, but I'm just wondering if you have experienced, not necessarily through your work, but just people in general, because of the state of this country's mentality, if people are complaining that there are angels on public buildings because it's a violation of separation of church and state. And of course, my first comment to someone of that ilk would be, that angel has been on that building for 700 years. Why is it a problem for you now?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Well, people like to have something to fight about.
That's
a really interesting question, because I think, I don't know if the angel is telling me this now, but what's coming to me is that because we're in such a tumultuous time, I mean, we have been for centuries, I think, mm-hmm. ever since this country was started, they've been fighting. So that people need something to express themselves about, like, you know, why is this or why is that? And that's the only thing that I can think of why people would want to cause a problem about it. And interesting, because as you were speaking about that, there is in the book, And it's another very famous building. It's a landmark building, and this is a gorgeous building. The whole front of the building is carved, and it's cream-colored limestone. It's just, it's like creamy color.
Mm-hmm.
And on the top of the building, along the roof line, they call it the cornice, that's where the roof is, mm-hmm. right under that ledge, are six angels. They're huge. And this building is... It's named after the man who paid for it, Connaught or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't have any bearing on this. But these angels, their arms are outstretched, and I see them as really looking over Lower Manhattan. I mean, they're such protectors because they're just standing there with their arms outstretched, and they're now lit. They finally have lit them so that you can see them at night because they are totally exquisite. And there was something else I wanted to tell you about them, but I can't remember what that is now.
So that's
on the front of a building. But you can't really, nobody really knows that they're there because they're so high up. And that's what I wanted to tell you. They are the architect of the building, is a very famous architect, mainly in Chicago. He created the first skyscraper, and his name was Louis Henry Sullivan, and his work was gorgeous, and he was the mentor to Frank Lloyd Wright. I would think it would have been the other way around, but he was older than Wright. So he was the mentor to Frank Lloyd Wright, but he was doing all this kind of Baroque-y stuff. Wow. But the man who paid for the building wanted angels on the building. And Sullivan said, absolutely not. I'm not putting angels on one of my buildings. That's not who I am. I just will not do it. And they thought over this for weeks, months probably. And finally he succumbed. And he put these angels up. I mean, they are just unbelievably beautiful.
Hmm.
So that is, you know, public. I mean, very public.
Yeah. And what's kind of beautiful about that story is that he did come around, and I don't, who knows, maybe there was an angelic influence somewhere along the way.
I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah.
But absolutely. At the same time, I also acknowledge too that in spite of the influence, it was still his choice, and that's the beautiful thing about it is that he did make that choice. You have one particular photograph that's in your book, Angels of New York.
Yes.
That touches on a subject that we have dealt with many times on this program. I can't think of any other phrase but say it's near and dear to my heart, only because I am just extremely curious. And that subject is death and dying or transitioning.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm always curious. That person passes away. Well, what are they doing now? What's happening? And I've been involved with a local gentleman here having to do with a process known as a life between lives.
Mm.
And it's fascinating. And I have to say that the session that I went through took me back to my last life before this one, and then the transition between the two and all of that. But you have a particular piece of work called Death's Compassionate Embrace, which was actually featured in a book about death. And I'm curious, first of all, about the photograph and where it's located and what you know about it, but also about your particular perspective, because, you know, we have in the West specifically, and not maybe not exclusively, but it does seem so, we've got the hardest time dealing with that subject. And yet we've got so many entities, I'm going to use that term, who are there to help us through that.
Yeah.
And that's why I love that word, that title, Death's Compassionate Embrace.
Yeah, I like that title. I don't know how I came about with that title, but I do love that, yes. I was actually going to mention that earlier when we were talking about the public angels. That is a war memorial, World War I memorial in Prospect Park, which is in Brooklyn. Prospect Park is very well known. It's not quite as big as Central Park, but it's very, very well known and very beautiful. You know, the landscaping in New York parks are just like, you know, you just want to go live there. You know, you don't need a house anymore.
Yeah.
Yes, that angel is, first of all, the angel is exquisite. And when I first went there, because I'd been told about it, and so I got my friend who lives in Brooklyn to pick me up at the subway at 6 a.m. because we had to get the right light. So that's, and when I got up to the angel, I just gasped, because if you look closely at the photograph, you can see it, that the sculpture has like a veil over its face. And that means, you know, that she's not quite here. I think this is a male angel. But it was a soldier, and if you notice with the soldier's gun is cut off. And I mean, it's implied, but it's not talked about on the statue, on the war memorial. It has names, you know, like a war memorial would have. But you know that the soldier has died or is about to die, and the angel is there to help him, just as you're talking about, transition over. Because that's one of the things that angels do. And angels have specific jobs. And Archangel Michael, Archangel Michael, you mean anything you call on Archangel Michael, that's the rule of the day usually. But Archangel Michael is also one of the angels that will help people over, and also Gabriel. They're known as benevolent angels, and they help people transition. And that's exactly what this angel is doing, is helping this soldier, you know, die and go over. And one of the story that I wrote with it is about the, you know, the war story of Gallipoli?
Share that a little. Maybe it'll jog my memory.
And actually, they I think it was on PBS, they actually did a TV drama about it. There was, when it was World War One, and it was about Britain. I think Gallipoli is somewhere in Britain, I'm not sure. And the Australian men, and they were very, very young, they decided they were going to go to Britain and help out. And this was at Gallipoli, the site of Gallipoli. And they were all, like, instantly killed because they were so young and they didn't know what they were doing. And the story goes that there were witnesses that saw what had happened, and this golden cloud, this was in real life, golden cloud comes down and whisks these human beings away, and then when the cloud lifted, the human beings weren't there anymore.
Wow.
So that's the second name that I have on this angel. It's called Angel of Gallipoli, a death, compassionate embrace.
Yeah.
And so that is a true story. And so that's what I saw in this angel. Oh my goodness, this is a Gallipoli story. This is, you know, this is probably what happened. And so that's why, because it's such a unique kind of thing that happened because someone saw it.
Yeah. Wow.
It wasn't just a fictional story.
That's remarkable. How long have you been into taking pictures, into photography?
Well, I was doing photography before I became a healer, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And I paid for my healing school with my photography. So that was, I started healing in 84, 85. So I must have been, I started photographing in 1980, when I was practicing. And then I became a professional photographer around 82, when I went to Findhorn, Scotland. And when I got those pictures back, I said, oh, wow. And that was sort of the beginning of it, yeah.
Now, were you involved in the process from taking the shot all the way to printing the pictures?
No, because I'm not a techie person, which is interesting, being a photographer. So I never was interested in developing. Although one summer I did take a printing course.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a color photographer, And so most printing people do all their black and white stuff in the dark room.
Yeah. Well,
I
took a photography class in college back in the early 80s, and it was black and white, and I immersed myself in it to the extent where I had a 35 millimeter canister to develop the film. I had shelves set up in my bedroom, which was also my brother's bedroom. We shared a room where I had the trays with the chemicals. Learned a very important lesson. Do not use metal trays. Use plastic because it ate little holes in it. And, of course, I had chemicals all over the floor. And then, of course, I had an enlarger. And I had the most fun with that, being able to create different images, not only in terms of the negatives that I was creating, but also I had this clear plastic geometric puzzle that I could rearrange into different shapes, and then I would set it onto the photographic paper, turn the light on, and expose the paper and so forth, and just got some of the most unique images of that. And I loved that process from beginning to end because I was in total control from beginning to end.
Yes.
Now, I can still do that. Only now, of course, it's digital, and I put them into Photoshop if they need to be touched up. And the real irony is my wife and I have been to Ireland twice. The first time we took these disposable cameras and took a bunch of pictures. I think it was over 400 pictures that I took. And when we got home, of course, I gave them to the place, and they, of course, put them up online, and I was able to download them, so they were digitized. I had to touch up every single one of those to brighten them up a little bit, right?
Right.
The following year that we went, 2004, I had a digital camera, and I don't remember how many pictures. It could have been about the same, I didn't have to touch up a single one of those, which was rather remarkable, but it also spoke to the lack of flexibility of the disposable camera, that you couldn't change the aperture and the f-stops and so forth.
Yes. Oh, God.
But I loved it. I mean, I loved the process of creating in that respect. It's just incredible. You touched upon something I want to jump into when we get back from our break, and that fact is that you mentioned that you were that you're a healer. Well, we're going to talk to you more about that when we come back from our break, what kind of a healer you are and other spiritual work that you do here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Do me a favor, folks. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true today. We are talking about angels. We're talking specifically about angels of New York and a fascinating, in my opinion, a fascinating book. I love pictures. I am, believe it or not, one of those who did read the articles in Playboy. I want you to know that. I just didn't look at the pictures. I love picture books. I love this kind of work because it brings to mind so many different things that we've talked about. But also, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, and I'm sure you probably had these experiences as well, or at least you've heard of them, heard of these stories of the angels being with us at our challenging times of life, you know, those moments. But you also have an expression that flows through you. And this is fascinating to me because my career of 40 years thus far has been dealing in nothing but sound. And you are a sound healer and a spiritual teacher with a passion, for helping others grow and transform. Now, I remember in a conversation I had with one of my guests, I used the word change. And they said, you might want to change that because if you change it in one direction, it can be changed back. Whereas if you transform it, I suppose you could transform it the other way. Transformation is a little more permanent.
Oh,
I thought, okay. I mean,
I never thought about that.
Yeah. I hadn't either.
That's amazing. And it's true.
Yeah. Tell me about your healing attributes, if you will. When did you become aware that you were a healer?
Oh, that's so funny because that goes along with the photographing. I was photographing when I was started out photographing. I was photographing windows and doorways and things of that sort. And someone told me about this church in the city, and that it had incredible arches. You must go there. That and the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. And so I went to this church called Calvary Church, which is on Park Avenue and 21st Street, if anybody's listening that knows the area. And the architect that built St. Patrick's Cathedral. And actually this church, this small church, is said to have been his practice church before St. Patrick's. And you can see a big likeness in the church in the columns. And so I was there in the summer photographing these wonderful arches and the stained glass windows and just everything. It was gorgeous. And the choir director was walking around because they were fixing the organ and doing all kinds of things, which was a great time to be there when all this hubbub was happening and you could hear the organ being tuned, and it was, you know, right out of the movies. And so he's coming and he's looking at all my pictures that were laid out on a church pew, and he said, "Oh, you take pictures." He said, "Do you also sing?" And I said, "Well, I used to, but I don't really anymore. I was a trained singer, so I didn't want to say." And so he said, "Well, you don't even have to really sing." He said, "If you can just carry a tune a little bit." He said, "We are doing this big concert on Foray, and I'm looking for some new voices. Would you come and audition?" And so I said, "Ooh, okay." And so the rest is history. So I became part of this church based on the music and the arts, because it was a church that was, the focus was a lot of art, because both of the priests there were artists. One was a sculptor, an architect, and the other one was a painter. And so when I was going to a church service there, they announced that they had this healing service. And if anybody was interested in joining in and being one of the healers, to come forward and give us your name. So I thought, well, that sounds kind of interesting. I'll do that. About 6 months later, a friend of mine told me that she was taking this healing course, and of this woman, her name was Barbara Brennan, and that she had a book coming out soon, and she needed someone to help her manage her office that she was opening in New York City. And it turns out that she needed somebody part-time, and I lived one block away, and so, of course, I was a photographer, so I was part-time. And I went, was interviewed, and we fell in love with each other. And I was hired, and I said, "Well, you know, the reason I think that I'm here with you and, you know, you're hiring me is because I'm supposed to study with you, not work for you." And she said, "Well, I'm sorry about that." She said, "If you work for me, you can't study with me, or vice versa." Because she had some very bad experiences. And so I said, "Okay." And so that's where my healing career started, was working for Barbara Brennan. And then her book came out, and like 4 months later, and she had to get a full-time secretary and, you know, office keeper and blah, blah, blah. That was not me, because I could not type. I was one of those people that said, "I do not type." But now that's changed. But and then I studied with her, and I graduated, and, you know, the rest is history. And it's energetic work, working with the chakras and the energy field. But I also, she was actually the one that asked me, "That's interesting, two people." I just got that, Richard. Two people have asked me if I sang, and that changed my life. Because she said, in class one day, and there were 40 people in the room, and she came over, because, you know, the teacher always walks around and corrects your hand positions and gives you tips and that kind of thing. And she said, "Do you sing?" same question.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, maybe a little. She said, well, I think it would be good to sing now to this client. I said, but everyone in the room will hear me. She said, that's the whole point. She said, we need to change the energy in this room. And so the rest is history, because so then I started chanting, and I tone into the chakras and all manner of sounds. And now I use a lot of alchemy crystal singing bowls. I don't know if you've ever heard of those. I use drums. It's kind of a mix of angelic and shamanic. And now I've also, like any other trade, one does have to upgrade themselves. And so I have done that on several occasions. And so now I'm working in a modality called Christ healing. And it's working with all of the spirits and the Christ energy and the Holy Mother. And it sounds very Roman Catholic, but it's not at all. It's very galactic. The part of it is galactic, and we're working with the galactic energy and the galactic beings.
Yeah. It works for me.
Right. And it's just I love it because it's I don't see like in front of me. Some people do in the three dimensions. I don't see. I see in my mind's eye. And I have what's called direct knowing. So I know something, and then I will touch it, and then I will see it. And every healer does it in either one of the five senses, healing, touch. They're strong in that. Mm. And so I was never kinesthetic, which is touching and knowing, but now I am. But I guess I was. I just didn't know it. But I work with the angels, of course, And there are healing angels. There are angels that are specific for healing. And so I work a lot with that. And the interesting thing is that crystal singing bowls, they carry the same vibration as the angelic realm.
Hmm. Well, believe it or not, I used to own one.
Oh!
I used to own one.
Oh.
Lost it in the divorce. But I know how they sound. They're beautiful.
Yes. Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. I actually got fairly good at playing it. But yeah, it is an extraordinary tool, I will put it in that context.
Yes. Yes.
And it's just fascinating to be in a space where you're hearing these just incredible notes, yeah. These tones. I will share with you also that, excuse me,
yeah.
That as a child growing up,
yeah.
I remember I had, I don't know if it was the flu or it was something, and I was laying in bed moaning. And one of my sisters and my mother came into the room, and my sister was a little put off by it. She says, Mom, make him stop.
Oh, God.
Now, this is just from my remembrance. And my mother says, no, that's how he heals himself.
Ah.
And I never really actually logically connected those two things.
Yeah.
It was just something that I intuitively did. And now today I tell people, I said, if you feel like moaning because you're not feeling good, do it. And the right tone will come to you. Your body will tell you what your vocal cords need to produce to help you through this process.
That is a thrilling story. I love that.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's something that I have been very fortunate that I haven't been sick much, thank goodness, in the last 20 or 30 years. Matter of fact, I can't even remember the last time I had a flu shot. And I'm sorry to the pharmaceutical industry, but I have no intention of ever taking it because... Yeah. And of course, the only comparison, and I hate to use this comparison because I'm not a real fan of the military, but the only way that your personal internal military, your immune system, can be strong enough to fight off these things is to be allowed to fight.
Yes.
If they aren't allowed to fight, then they get weakened. And if you take antibiotics, you're weakening it even further.
Right.
You know, and so on and so forth. So I try to stay away from that stuff. Do I not take medications? No, I do. I do. I have high blood pressure, and I'm working on that too, on an energetic level. But in the meantime, I have to outlive my great grandmother, and she lived to be 100 years old, and I'm only 58. So I've got at least, at a minimum, of 42 years to go. Okay.
Yes.
So I want to make sure that that I'm here. But at the same time, Sylvia Moss is my guest today. If today were my day, I'm good. I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
You know, by the way, this program is therapy for me. That's I tongue in cheek say that. But at the same time,
sure.
And you also have other modalities that you have incorporated, and not just sound. And of course, sound is a big deal. We've had a gentleman by that you may be familiar with, Jonathan Goldman.
Yes, absolutely. Oh my God, he's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, they just celebrated prior to this program. They just celebrated, I think, International Healing Day, something along those lines. And to me, it's just fascinating, the whole concept and aspect of sound. There was also a gentleman who I was privileged to narrate the video for, the documentary about Royal Raymond Rife and Rife frequency generator back in the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
And I discovered something I want to share with you, and then I want to have you elaborate on this a little bit if you can.
Okay.
I discovered in my early days in broadcasting, we used turntables, and the engineer came in and installed one of the turntables, which was a stereo unit. And we wanted to test it, so he plugged it in and wired it up, and we put the record on and played it, and it didn't sound right. I thought, well, that's weird. The vocal was way in the background somewhere. He says, oh, hold on a second. And he made a correction in the wiring, and the next thing you know, the vocal comes right to the front, right? And I says, what happened? He says, well, one channel was out of phase. Well, I really didn't know what that meant until the mid-90s. And I was playing around with stereo waveforms on the computer. And I took a genuine stereo left-right separation signal, and I took one channel, and I flipped it horizontally so it's out of phase. And then I mixed the two files together into one. And it did exactly the same thing that happened with the record player earlier in my career.
Wow.
Then I took a mono signal that was left right, and I flipped one channel and I mixed them together into one channel, and there was no signal. Because the difference between the two examples is that the first one, there were similar and dissimilar frequencies, whereas in the second example, there were identical frequencies. And I have to wonder, number one, if these pretty popular noise canceling headphones don't work under that same kind of principle, where they're able to detect almost instantaneously whatever sounds are around you and create the counter sound, if you will, or anti sound, so that you don't hear anything. What about and that, of course, leads me to think that everything is vibrating. Everything has a frequency, right?
Yes.
So if you have dis-ease in your body, that means that there's something that is vibrating at a rate that if you could find the balancing, and not the counter necessarily, but let's say the balancing frequency, that you could get yourself back into balance, right?
Correct. Absolutely.
Talk to us a little bit about this whole thing.
That's brilliant, because that excuse me, that is exactly what energetic healing is about. It's bringing you, a lot of people use balance. I like to use the word alignment. It's a more descriptive word for me, because let me see if I can put the visual, the visual of this in words. My main tool is working with the chakras. And so we're going to go back a little bit here. So working with the chakras, when we're out of balance or out of alignment, the first place to go is to your chakras. because they're going to that's what's out of balance. So the chakras, to anyone who doesn't know, they are invisible, but that we actually have them. It's like, you know, it's like you have an energetic field, but you can't see it. And it's an Indian word, and they've been discovered like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years and been written about. So there are seven major chakras on our body. There's front ones and back ones, and they're like little cones of energy. They can go out like in a second. Like if somebody yells or somebody coughs or startles you, a chakra can go off. And you just have to, it's like pottery. You sort of have to bring it back a little bit. So they have a frequency. They spin at a certain frequency. So the idea in healing, in energetic healing, is to meet that whatever that chakra is, let's say it's the throat chakra, since we're talking about sound. If that throat chakra is spinning at a lower rate, you have to meet it at that rate. And then you bring it back. And then when you bring it back and then you make it in alignment or balance it out with the other chakras, then you're well. So that's the whole principle of being ill, having disease, is that things are out of balance or out of alignment. And so all an energetic healer does is just gracefully, it's like a dance, it just gracefully meets that energy and sort of dances with it until it brings it back up in a very gradual way. And that's why the angels and the spirit guides help us so much, because they're working with us to bring all of this back, because we're not doing it. God is moving it. Now, atheists can listen to this too, but you don't have to believe in God to know that this works, because it's very scientific. That sounds strange, but healing is scientific, because they have done tests on it. There's a very famous woman by the name of Valerie Hunt. She is I don't know what kind of a doctor, but she works in the lab, and they've done testing with electrodes on people. Rosalind Breyere and Valerie Hunt did tests on if Rosalind did something with a chakra or with someone's energy, it would show up on the screen in the sound room. And so they know that this works. Valerie Hunt is still alive today in her 90s, and she produces videos of energy moving. And so so the idea is that everything has a frequency. And so this segues into, I didn't come upon it. My spiritual teacher mentioned it, and I took off and ran with it, is that everything in our life is frequency. That I knew. But the deal is right now is we have to raise our frequency. And so my work and my live events with the Crystal Bowls, which I just started doing in a different way, is all about raising the frequency. So everything that I'm doing in the events with the Crystal Bowls, whether I'm singing, whether I'm toning, or I'm just playing the bowls, it's all focused on raising, expanding the frequency. Because if we don't expand our frequency, we're going to stay stuck. We're going to stay right where we are, the third dimension. We're not going to go anywhere. We will not grow. Even our frequency is about our transformation. So it's a very, I became so passionate about this about 3 months ago when I started saying, you know, reshaping my events on focusing on how can I help people raise their frequency. And there have been tests with sound on drums. It's been documented. I have it on my website. I forget the doctor's name, but they tested sound and what it does, and to people's energy and to people's bodies.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to say that one of the most fascinating things that happened to me when I shared that discovery, I didn't discover it. I came across it, and it's you know, it was obviously something that was used. But when I shared this with a gentleman by the name of I think it was Stephen Lewis, who wrote a book called Sanctuary. And he has a computer where you send in a picture of yourself, a photograph of yourself, head to toe. He puts it into his computer, and what he does is he analyzes it, and it's able to pick up those imbalances, if you will. Okay? And then what the computer does is it sends out those balancing frequencies, if you will.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
Well, when I shared my findings about phase and out of phase with the stereo mono signal, he was taken aback, like, wow, you know, this is not it wasn't something he wasn't aware of, but that someone was coming to him with this info. Well, then when I went to go through the process of setting up an interview, I was going through his secretary, and I shared that with her too, just in passing. And she said, oh, no, he does not want to talk about that, because that if that information falls into the wrong hands, blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking, what do you mean if it falls into the wrong hands? I'm not the only one who knows that this exists, okay? I don't think that I'm the only human being on the planet who ever discovered this or found this, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I did several interviews with him subsequently, so it was of no effect in that regard. But it's always fascinated me, this aspect of sound. And I'm curious, what are your experiences with the higher frequency versus lower frequency tones? Are there particular uses that you have found? Have you tracked any of this in that regard, or is it all just intuitive? You don't bother about any of the statistical, shall we say, data that might be compiled. Okay, the low frequencies are for these conditions, mid range for these, and high for these, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I do know that. And the man who created the alchemy crystal bowls, on the back of their brochure, he has a diagram of what the different tones are for. And of course, it's very, I would assume most people would realize that the lower tones are for grounding and being more, you know, more in the physical world, and the higher tones are for being in the more etherical world. And that is actually true. But in my work, and I don't know how I knew this. Well, I guess it was just one of those guidance kind of things. But when I don't do this much anymore because I don't really like to work on cancer that much, because I won't go into that. you don't know what the outcome is going to be, because that's really a roulette. Playing with roulette when you're working on cancer, and it's needed. I mean, if someone comes to me and they have cancer, I definitely will work on them. But I just don't want to do it anymore, because I can't promise anything, so that makes me sad. But people have been cured by using sound healing, doing what I've been doing. So I found that if you're trying to kill off a cancer cell, you use the highest pitch tone that you can do. It's like almost screeching, and you use it only for a very short period of time. It's almost like acupuncture, because they're similar, and because they're working with the energy, and they're working with degrees of energy, and how to know when to use the right amount. And so we have to, as healers, we have to listen really closely to the guidance. How much is enough? How much is not enough? How much is too much? Like when you're doing healing, because I do hands-on, I touch. Reiki, you don't touch, I touch.
Mm-hmm.
And I work on the organs. I work on from the outer to the inner, and move things around and all kinds of things like that, which is great fun. But when you're working, you have to be able to listen to your guidance. Like go a little deeper, up too much. Just like a musical instrument. And it's very real. And the very high pitched tones, and you want to go after the mother cell. I don't know where this came from either, but I was just told the mother cell. You want to go for the mother cell. You just don't want to do a general thing. You want to go for the mother cell, and you ask for the mother cell. You don't have to know exactly where the mother cell is in the body, but in the general direction. It's fascinating. But And so the middle range tones are for middle range different things, and the solar plexus is a very big wounded area on people's bodies, and the solar plexus is right above your of a person's diaphragm, and when you sound into that, that's the place that the sound is most effective, because that's where most people's wound is. It's the wound of the child.
Yeah.
So yes, there is documentation on all of this. I don't get into statistics because that's just not who I am. But and interestingly enough, my brother was a zoologist and a biologist. So so we span both ends of the spectrum. He was a scientist and I'm the intuitive. So I always found that very interesting.
Well, and I'm curious as to have there any collaborations taken place between the two of you?
No, not really. He's passed now, and I think that probably we have on the other side. But when Barbara Brennan's book came out, I sent him a copy because she's a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
She still is a scientist. She's still alive. She's a scientist. She was a scientist with NASA, and she's a physicist. And so she approached this both from the intuitive, spiritual, and scientific. So I thought he might enjoy that. And so he told me later on that he gave the book that I gave him to his girlfriend, who was a nurse. And she loved the book. And after she read it for a while, she came back and she told him, I see a lot of this stuff in the hospital. She sees it and she didn't know what she was seeing, especially when people were dying and very ill. She saw things moving around their body and things happening to their bodies.
Mm.
So that a lot of nurses, there is a school of healing. It's called Touch, Something Touch. And it was developed by a woman who was a nurse. Her first name is Dee, but I can't remember her last name. And all the nurses have taken her course, and they do healings in the hospital when the scientists aren't looking. But I've done healings in the hospital, and I've been given permission, and I asked for not to be disturbed, and that they're fine with that because they know what's going on.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting. So we're all on the same page.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting too. There was a CD that came out, and actually, it came out. Wow, 22 years ago, In Search of Angels. And I believe, if I have the name here correct, Tim Story is the one who put this together, but it's not just, it's various artists. My wife and I have listened to it many, many times over the years, and it seems to have disappeared. I started looking for it again. I know we have it. It's just I got to find it in the right spot. In any event, there's a song on it called Calling All Angels.
Yes.
You're familiar with that? Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Because we've heard that song. Am I not mistaken? It was the closing song to the movie Pay It Forward.
Yes.
Yes.
Because I can hear it in my head now. Yes, it was the closing. Yes, pay it forward. Yeah.
In your experience as a healer,
yes.
How do we? What is the best way for us to communicate and or to call upon the angels? And second part of that question would be, and for what reason or reasons?
Angels are, I tell people this all the time because a lot of people think, well, if there are angels around, they're going to help me. No, they are. They are going to help you. That's what they're there for. They have to be asked. So there are, I don't know how many angels in the room right now, but there are several right in front of me. I can see them. I know they're there. And, they're communicating with me just on a simple level. But if anybody wants to communicate with an angel, there's two ways. Number one is just to ask. Say, is there an angel here? I need help. And you can just, like you're talking on the phone or something to someone, and you can just talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
You may see them, you may not see them. The other way, which is a kind of a fun way, is the automatic writing way, Mm-hmm. And you, you know, you ground yourself. Grounding yourself is meaning like putting your feet on the ground and like having your energy go into the earth and just really coming down into your into your body and being very present. You would think the opposite, but no. You first have to ground so that you're not out of your body. So you're in your body, and then you just go to your heart. Mm. And you have a pad of paper and a pen, and you write down your question. Now, you can do it two ways. You can do this at night. You can write your question, and you ask for this to be told to you in your dreams or when you wake that you will have the answer. And then you're going to write it down. So, or you can just ask your question, write it down, tune into your heart, just be very present in your heart, and then pick up the pen and just write. Do not think. Do not say it. Do not have a thought in your head. Just write from your heart. And you have to do this physically. You can't do it on the computer. You can't type it. It has to come through your body. That's an energetic thing. And this works all the time. And if it doesn't work, it means that you need to go back into ground a little bit and just relax. In the beginning, it might seem a little hokey. Like, oh, how can this possibly be? How would I know that? But it's coming through you because everyone is intuitive. And we live, I write about this in the book, in the prologue also. We live in a world that has invisible things around us. We live in a world of energy. I mean, people talk about energy all the time. They're talking about it more and more now. But we live in an invisible world. I mean, because we live with the spirits. And the animals, that's what's with animals. I mean, they know the spirit world. And you can communicate with your animals because there are animal communicators. It's the same thing. So it's really about slowing down, being grounded, and being in your heart. Three very easy steps. Now, the hardest one for most people, because we're human beings on planet Earth, is going to our heart, being in our heart, because we're not used to it. It's a practice. And once you get into it, it is great fun. You can actually help your high blood pressure, because I have high blood pressure, and I had to work on it. I was given medication, but he said I didn't have to take the medication if I didn't want to, but he did advise it because he was also an Ayurvedic doctor. And breathing is the key to bringing down your blood pressure. And we can talk about that another time.
Sure.
But, and that is the thing that I use. But automatic writing really helps it become physical, become real for you.
Hmm.
And there are all kinds of things of people have invited angels into their house, and they for 5 days. It's a whole ceremonial kind of thing, and it's like a chained letter that's been passed around, and you have to sign up to have the angels come to your house. I mean, it's a whole world of just magic, but
yeah.
Real magic. It's real, and that's what's so fascinating because it's very real. Because we just can't see it.
Right, exactly. And you used a word I wanted to dive into also before we run out of time here.
Yeah.
You used the word, I think you used the word ceremony. How important are rituals and traditions and ceremony in our, not only spiritual life, but even in our healing or, let's say, preventative maintenance, if you will?
Yeah, great question. Oh, my God. Very important. I realize as you ask that question, so much of what I do in my daily life is almost like a ritual. I mean, I become quiet on with some things. When I cook, I'll have the TV on if it's a show that I didn't plan on watching and I need to watch it. So I'll just turn the TV on while I'm cooking. But most of the time, I cook in silence, and that's a macrobiotic theory that when we cook, we want to be very conscious about what kind of energy we're in. We don't want to cook when we're angry, because that anger is going to go into the food, and that's been documented. And so you want to make sure of what restaurants you eat in.
Yeah, You know, so, I've even asked the question in that regard. I've even asked the question of food preparers, chefs, you know,
yes.
and cooks and so forth. I said, have you ever tried to do this? Have you ever tried to cook? You have the same recipe and you're going to cook it twice. Only the first time, what you're going to do is you're going to get yourself all worked up. You're going to get yourself upset and angry and frustrated and so forth. And you're going to, and you'll cook that food. You make the recipe. I don't know if this would work if you're doing this and you're conscious of it. And then yeah. you're going to calm yourself down. You're going to get into a peaceful place and you're going to say, there are people out there that are here because they want to try my food and da 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 da, and I want to give them the best. And you just put that love into it and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You say there have been tests done. I'm wondering if those tests have been done in that way to show the different flavors, the tastes, or even just the energetic of the food that that they're consuming.
I don't know if the test has been done of that sort, but there have been books written in the macrobiotic field. One very famous one is You Are What You Eat. And that's kind of a popular thing now in the nutrition field. But it's not based on the macrobiotic, but it's just that they picked up on that phrase. But that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would imagine that they have in some way, because they know what to do and what foods to eat for certain things. And I did a paper once for my graduation. We had to do thesis,
mm-hmm.
and so mine was on the energetics of food. And so food changes, whether it's the components of it, how it affects you, whether it's raw, medium raw, or cooked. It changes the molecules on how you cook it. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And it also, you can say, oh, the macrobiotic person that I went to for a consultation a couple times said that he did with a client once, that he took them to the grocery store. And he said, one of the things that you do is when you go shopping, of course you have to sort of project yourself into the week, what kind of energy do I need? Like if I'm shopping for today, or if I'm going to cook some food, what kind of energy do I need? And you ask yourself that, and then you look to, well, what food has that energy?
Hmm. Wow, yeah. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also the way you cook it. Steamed makes it much lighter.
Right.
And boiling or simmering makes it more grounded. And there are different dishes that you prepare for grounding or for being lighter and like that. It's fascinating. It's a whole world in itself.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Reiki earlier. I happen to be, both my wife and I happen to be Reiki masters. We got our training back in the late 90s, back in Phoenix, from a good friend of ours. And the one thing I remember about the training in particular was the fact that with Reiki specifically, not necessarily exclusively, the purpose of performing a Reiki treatment, if you will, on someone, whether it be there in the room or absentee,
mm-hmm.
was that what you were doing was you were being the conduit of that energy, sending out to that person or situation, mm-hmm. and then allowing that person or situation to use it as they deem fit.
Yes.
Now, my mother and father, my father had one of his, I believe, brothers was diagnosed with cancer, and he lived in Miami, Arizona. And we had just finished our training, and we wanted to, you know, support him in some way, so we asked my parents for a photograph. They gave us one. We took it home, and we sat, and we performed an absentee healing. Now, some people say healing, well, then you're expecting him to be healed. I said, well, no.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the terminology.
Yeah.
We sent the energy, and then we got a report back after his passing that the next day he'd fed up. He got angry. There was enough energy where he was actually able to throw his medications across the room.
Wow.
He then got in his wheelchair, and he wheeled across the compound where they lived to his son's house. And apparently they had a time of father-son time of bonding and closure. And within the next day or so, I guess, he passed.
Uh-huh.
And I interpreted that as we gave him enough energy to do those things so that he could finish what he needed to hear and then and then move on. And I just thought, wow, this is this is quite remarkable. Whereas growing up in broadcasting at a Christian radio station where they had live call-in prayer programs, people would call in for their healing, so you'd pray for their healing. And I always thought that there was a dichotomy there because it's like, well, wait a minute. If you acknowledge that you're sick, you have to acknowledge that you're in disease or you have an illness or what have you before you can ask for your healing.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, you've got to embrace the bad stuff before you can embrace the good stuff. You couldn't deny it. And it sort of reinforces that phrase where regardless of what it is in your life, you have to go through it.
Yes, that's true. And a lot of people, as you're saying that, going through it, a lot of people, the reason that they suffer, whether it's a life-threatening illness or just emotional, not just, but or whether it's emotional condition, whatever, you have to acknowledge it in order to pass it.
Yeah.
That's why there's so much shadow work. Like you've got to know that you've got killer in you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody does. You got to know that there's animal in you. I work a lot with clients. It's called bioenergetics or / core energetics, and you got to get down and dirty, like ah.
Mm-hmm.
but it's very true. And when people anger, because a lot of people are afraid of their own anger, and I always encourage clients like. You don't have to get angry here. Get angry at home. Just get in touch, because so many people think that they have to be angry at something in order to express the energy of it.
Yeah.
And once they do some animal work, they're liberated.
Yeah.
Because it's not about being angry. It's about expressing the energy of it. Because the one thing, and a lot of people talk about this now. We said it earlier. Everything is energy.
Mm-hmm.
Even your anger, it's just pent up stuff in the
mm-hmm.
body.
Yeah.
And if you don't release it on a regular basis, whether you go dancing, you know, swimming, whatever, releasing that energy, that's how disease gets started.
Yeah, holding on to that energy is the problem. And all you have to do is take a look at people who, and you see the television programs, people who hoard. Look at their health conditions on their physical body, but look at the space in which they're living. You know, you can't move. You can't even get around freely. And I have to say that that people who have millions and millions and billions of dollars, they're hoarders too. It's just a different kind of hoarding, but it's still hoarding.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, not to get into the political realm here, but I learned a long time ago, as much as I would like to have 6 or 7 digits before the decimal point in my bank account, and I still dream of this, okay?
Yes.
I plan to set up outgoing auto pays to various nonprofits, if you will, that I believe in to support them to keep it flowing, right? That's to keep the flow going, right?
Exactly.
But the statistics, I think, are there already that are showing just how unhappy these people are.
Wow.
They're not happy just because they have these millions or billions. And what good is it doing you sitting there in a vault somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's
mm-hmm.
nothing wrong with accumulating that kind of wealth. And
right.
maybe they are. I know here in Santa Barbara, we have dozens, if not hundreds of philanthropists here who are very wealthy and they're contributing to the arts and they're contributing to the homeless situation.
Exactly.
They're contributing to all of these different things. But then there are a lot more who aren't.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, you know how I managed to accumulate this $5 billion.
Right.
I didn't spend it on use. And they're even looking for coupon deals. It's like, are you kidding me?
Wow.
You know, I have to tell you, my wife taught me a very, very valuable lesson. And we don't have the 5 or 6 or 7 digits before the decimal yet. Yet.
Yet, exactly.
But she taught me, having been born and raised here, she was born and raised here in Santa Barbara. What she taught me was sometimes it's not worth it to get a deal. I remember we went to a shoe store back in 1998. We were visiting Santa Barbara, one of the nicer shoe stores here in Santa Barbara. And I bought a pair of shoes for the ungodly amount of $135. Now, that was right. In my head, right? Back then, right? Do you know how long those shoes lasted me?
Oh.
10 years.
Wow.
10 years.
Yes.
That's $13 a year. You can't buy a pair of shoes, even a cheap pair of shoes, for $13 a year and have them last. Okay?
That's true.
So I learned that lesson, and the next pair, believe it or not, the next pair of shoes that I bought, and I actually bought 2 pair, $165.
Wow.
And I'm still wearing them.
Wow.
And they feel great. They're comfortable.
Yep.
So when it comes to caring for self, and then now we're getting back to self, our physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual well-being, mm-hmm. it's going to pay now to take care of it. Like you say, express that energy. Find some outlet for that energy and keep that energy flowing.
Yeah, it's all about flow.
Yeah.
Exactly. When you were talking about the money thing, because there's a, I don't know if it's a book or where, it was one of the workshops, many workshops that I've taken,
mm-hmm.
That money has to flow. Money's energy.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to flow.
Yeah.
It has to flow.
Yeah, exactly. This is fascinating. I want to continue this, but we are fast approaching the end of our program. Sylvia Moss, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. I encourage people to go to angelsofnewyorkbook.com, angelsofnewyorkbook.com. That is the website. We encourage you to go there. And, of course, your personal website will be floating around here very soon here in 2019. And people will be able to get there through the angelsofnewyorkbook.com, and we encourage them to go there. I also encourage you, Sylvia, should you ever find yourself astray of New York, although I know it's a great place. I was there in 1993 with my first wife. We were there for a week, and I got to tell you, I got a charge out of that place. We were walking in Manhattan. We walked down through Battery Park and down to Greenwich Village. We then walked back up to Central Park. You know that big fountain that was featured in the closing credits of the TV series The Odd Couple? We found ourselves there, and then we saw this huge crowd that was headed our way. And we didn't know it at the time, and I was unaware that that was Earth Day. That was 500,000 people were heading in our direction. Of course, we were rather scared, so we got out of the park in a hurry.
Oh, my God.
But I loved it. But if you should ever find yourself westward, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. Otherwise, you know, we'll do it over the phone, via Skype, what have you, because this is some good stuff people need to hear about.
Yeah. Well, my daughter lives in Malibu, where she's now in Palm Springs because she's looking for a new apartment.
Mm-hmm.
But she and I'm supposed to be going out there, but this Christmas didn't work. So I will definitely be out there. So I will definitely look you up.
Wonderful. And then before we let you go, again, as a reminder to our listeners, if you're listening to the radio broadcast, you better get the podcast, because there's a whole lot more information there that you're going to want to hear. Also, go to angelsofnewyorkbook.com. That is her website. Sylvia Moss has been my guest, and I have 3 final questions for you.
Yes.
And the first is, who is Sylvia Moss?
Oh, gosh. That's a hard one. You know, there's a song called Who is Sylvia? Who is Sylvia Moss? Gosh, do I have to answer that now?
Hey, if you don't have an answer, it's okay.
No, I really don't, because it's, well, let me put it this way. I'm a very complex person, not complex like serious, but I have many facets. And my New Year's resolution for this year was to slow it down and not say yes to so many things. Because I'm interested in so many different things within the realm of healing and the arts. and that I take on more than I can handle, and then I get, that's why I have high blood pressure. But I do have one thing that my, I forgot to tell you this, that my, the Angel Book is being made into a card deck, like a tarot card deck.
Oh, but wonderful.
They call them wisdom cards.
Yes.
And so the deck is called The Angels Speak. And it, we're right in the middle of the graphics. And hopefully they'll go off to press in by the 1st of February. And it's, they're so gorgeous. I mean, they're totally different than the book. And it's all, they've all been channeled. So Sylvia Moss is a many, many splendid things.
That was the exact phrase I was just thinking of.
Not many splendid things. Not to let my ego get in here, but I have many things.
All right.
Yeah. And the other question was?
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Oh, that's easy. Transform people's lives, but really transform them. Transform them so that they can be happy. That there's a place in the book that says that the reason for this book is to, and the reason for the angels is to remind us that we were here to be joyful, to be happy. We are not here to suffer. That's all made up. We are not here to suffer. And if you can get religious about that, then we can have another conversation. But we don't have to suffer. We can have full, wonderful, wonderful, expansive lives. And that's really what my work is about.
Yeah, growing up a Catholic, I know all about the conversations around suffering.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they made it up.
Exactly. Yeah. And finally,
yeah.
What is your life's purpose?
You're bringing tears to my eyes. My life's purpose is to bring more light into the world. My I have a spiritual name. I study, my spiritual studies are with a woman by the name of Kuala from Australia, and she does things in person and online. And one of the courses that I took, that we were she channeled spiritual names for us, which my daughter thinks is hokey, but that's beside the point. So my name, my spiritual name is Rahana Zavina Raphael, Raphael being my family name. Clue. And then in another class, she told us the codes for the, she didn't translate everybody's name, but she gave us codes. And the first letters of my name was one of her examples, and it means bringer of the light. I fell on the floor when I heard it.
Well, for a few years after I met my second wife, for a few years, I actually was considering changing my name to a name that appeared in my metaphysical primer, Autobiography of a Yogi, in the story of the Tiger Swami and the tiger that he was to fight. The tiger's name was Raja Begum, which translates into princess. And I was going to take on the name Raja. And I was known as that for probably 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
So I can certainly understand the Rahana, and I think that's a beautiful name. And we thank you so much for sharing that and all this time with us. This has been fantastic, and I look forward to having you back sometime later in 2019 to converse more about many of these things.
I would love it. I've enjoyed this so much, Richard. Thank you very much.
You are very welcome. Again, my guest, Sylvia Moss, and the website is angelsofnewyorkbook.com. We will be linked to her website. We encourage you to go there, continue your evolutionary process, enjoy the inspirational photographs, the descriptions, and get more information from her. Maybe connect with her as far as the various healing modalities that she utilizes. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.